Hi gang, Sam here with a quick plug before this week's episode. If you head over to Audible now, you can buy the audiobook version of my book, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks, for just £2.99. It's a special promo by Amazon that only lasts until 28th of January, and I wanted to flag it to you. It's me reading the whole book aloud, basically. Give it a go. Anyway, on with the show. Hello and welcome to The Reset, a mental health podcast without all the bollocks. I'm Sam Delaney. My guest this week is the writer Luke Turner, co-founder of the excellent music site The Quietus, a contributor to The Guardian, Dazed and Confused, Vice, Enemy, Q, Mojo and tons of others. Luke's latest book is called Men at War, Loving, Lusting, Fighting, Remembering, 1939 to 1945. It's a blend of history, memoir and biography that explores masculinity in a fascinating and original way. Luke grew up obsessed with the Second World War, but as he got older, he started to see that the types of masculinity we associate with our war heroes was not something he could personally identify with. We've all got an idea of a strong, silent, brave type of man that represents the ideal model of masculinity and assume that was the sort of bloke who fought in the wars. But is that accurate? And even if it is, why do we aspire to be that sort of bloke? These are all themes in Luke's book and ones that I was very keen to explore with him. I hope you enjoy listening to our chat. Luke, welcome to The Reset.
Thank you very much for having me on, sir.
Real pleasure. Always a pleasure to have a fellow hammer on The Reset. And I'm sure we'll find some way of bringing the subject round to that at some point today.
I hope so.
I guess the thing that I'm really interested in that you've written so brilliantly about is that of masculinity. And in your book, Men at War, you sort of explore the way in which kind of stereotypes of masculinity have been sort of shaped around the you know, our perception of Second World War and all that sort of thing. And I want to get into that. But first, tell me a bit about your own fascination with the Second World War. Because it's pretty deep, isn't it? And you had it since a pretty young age. How did it come about?
Well, yeah, I was born in 1978, and the 60s and 70s was like the golden age of kids being into the war. But by the time I was a kid in the 80s, my mates weren't really, no one was at school was really into the war. The people were into football, Star Wars, which had kind of taken over the military thing. wrestling was creeping in. Yeah. Trainers and that sort of stuff, and I don't know why I was so into it. It's probably a lot of things in life. I think I've been reaction against my parents, who are quite religious, and you know, they weren't into war at all. I wasn't allowed guns. I wasn't allowed Star Wars toys. I couldn't afford them, to be honest. But I wasn't allowed militaristic things. So I think I got interested in it that way, and I just thought planes were really cool. That was the main thing. I just loved aeroplanes. I thought they were brilliant. I finally got a model kit, built that. I used to build little Lego aeroplanes out of the space stuff with using the aerials as cannons. And I love watching the war films on a Sunday afternoon, like Guns of Navarone, all of that. And I don't know what it is. I still can't quite understand it. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of research by psychologists. Kids are kind of drawn to violence and explosions and excitement like that. It's an adrenaline thing. And I guess it was around in our culture a lot, even though it faded a bit by that point.
I remember when I was at school, round about, I'm like 3 years older than you, but it was a similar era. We'd play football with a tennis ball in the playground, and probably about 80% of the boys were doing that. But then there was a smaller group who we were friends with who would play war. And it was much smaller than the football group, but they would play war often across our football match. They'd be like lobbing pretend grenades and then ducking down with their hands over their ears as they waited for the grenade to go off.
Amazing.
It was certainly present in the play.
Yeah, see, I suppose, but by the time I got there, at least in my school, I was like that Japanese bloke who didn't surrender, and they found him in like 1958, still on the island fighting the war. I did eventually have one mate who I went around his house, and he had a computer, a PC, so we could play like flying games on it. And I had another mate who was quite into soldiers, and he could like beatbox distant battle sounds, like machine gun fire and explosions. So there was a couple of us, but yeah, it was kind of, I think that was the thing. I was really bad at football. I liked it. I got West Ham off my dad, everything, but I've always been shit at it. So I used to be the one kind of like wishing people would play war, you know, stick guns all that. I did actually at primary school did have a plot to, I thought if we attached a load of string to batteries and lit it, it would blow the school up. And I did get some people involved in that for a bit. Not sure I should be admitting that, actually.
But... well, it didn't work, presumably. So
it failed. So it was all right.
That's amazing. So did you, what was it? At that age, did you find like it just excitement? Was it just boys, plain old boys' own adventure stuff, basically?
Yeah, that's why I think that was it. You know, I thought the aeroplanes were really cool. The films, there was a sort of aspirational thing with the way these fellas dressed, and they were so sort of suave. And I guess the tragedy of it, I did, you know, you feel moved by it. But there is like writing the book about, like, I did always feel weird about putting the men in the cockpits of the aeroplanes. Yeah. I was a bit like, there's something a bit rum about this, having this little plastic man. And they're all the same, you know, like, yeah. The same German pilot flew every German plane, the same RAF fella flew all our planes. I just was a bit like, there's something a bit weird about that, a bit rum about it. And I guess that was the thing. It was all about, it's weird because for me, it's like quite a masculine fascination with war. But at the same time, I was ignoring the men who were fighting. You know, I didn't want to think about that. It was that I tried to push that to the back. But when I started reading, I got quite into reading war novels. And of course, that then starts bringing it a bit more into your mind, like what actually went on in the killing and how absurd a lot of it is.
Mm. Do you think it, you know, the movies in particular, and I guess the comics and stuff like that, were what shaped your idea of what being a sort of a real man was then? And did that last for quite a while?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, I think that there's an interesting thing where the British war films, they're none of the people in it particularly macho, are they?
They're all like John Le Mesurier.
Yeah, exactly. Who is my total hero? Yeah.
What suave gentleman.
Exactly. And you know, John Le Mesurier was both an icon for me and a bit of a formative crush. You know, because he could knocking off with Private Pike's mum, wasn't he?
Yeah,
brilliant. But I suppose in the comics, because I wasn't allowed comics, they were sort of strictly banned.
Right.
So I wasn't allowed comics. But like Union Jack Jackson, because I used to go to other people's houses or my cousins and read them. So he was quite macho. And the way the Germans always just sort of went, aye, and fell over. And they were always kind of like evil, but you could kill them quite easily. But I definitely, the suave thing, I really latched onto that. And it's not really well known film, but Force 10 from Navarone, which has got Harrison Ford in it. His first film after doing Star Wars, I think.
Wow.
And that's got one of the Fox brothers, I can't remember which one, playing this explosives expert called Miller. And he always had really cool, like, parachutist uniforms. And he'd, like, smoke a pipe and have a scarf and, like, just chuck these little sticks into things and they'd blow up. That's what I want to be. This is what I want to be. So, yeah, there was a sort of ideal of these, more this sort of like suave masculinity, a bit twinkly, you know, that sort of thing.
You write in the book about how, you know, the sort of the silence of the war generation, that, you know, and we've all heard of, you know, relatives and grandparents who just never spoke, barely at all, after they got back, is what allowed the sort of entertainment industry to create almost a false idea of these men who, in our culture and still to this day, you know, you see it in, as you write about it, but the rhetoric of particularly of the right and any sort of nationalist movement, we kind of revere this sort of idea of the heroic Second World War Tommy. But you kind of say, well, that was any of that real, or was it just invented by an entertainment industry? Right. And no one was going to deny it because all the real heroes were just kind of either dead or silent. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, I think some people, some veterans kind of were into talking about it, you know, and it's one thing that's quite interesting is how their testimony changes over the years, and it almost become they get wheeled out at things and they watch war films, and some of the testimony would change because they'd watched a war film, particularly The Longest Day. People at D-Day started mentioning stuff that was in The Longest Day that didn't happen at D-Day. So that the kind of media entertainment industry even influenced the lives of the men and the minds of the men who were actually there. I mean, let alone the rest of us. So I do feel like there was, this sort of silence. A lot of people's families didn't talk about it in depth. I mean, my granddad, who was in the war, he died long before I was born. My other granddad was a conscientious objector, which I write about in the book, which I was always a bit uncomfortable with because it was, you know, yeah, to be fair, probably felt he wasn't a real man in some ways, you know, and I thought he should have been fighting Hitler. So, yeah, and I think that because there was that bit of a silence, and then you get the idealized portrayals of these men, that's now meant, like, as you say, the kind of certain bits of the political spectrum to glom onto these people and sort of exploit them and say, you know, these are the true British heroes. Young people is all that it's always used in the tabloids, like, young people are, you're not as good as the Second World War generation. You'd never be able to do it. And it's kind of like picking apart the masculinity, I think, of a current generation, saying they're all snowflakes or whatever. But weirdly, you know, that's what I write in the book about how in the war, all these generals, British generals, were writing to each other going, problem is with the young men of today is they're not killers. They've been going to the cinema, listening to the wireless. But going on dates, you know, this is making a week and we can't get them to kill like the Germans do, you know. And so this is just like an age old thing that's been going on through history, isn't it? Young people are weak and soft and are crap.
And there was never a general. So, you know, I guess we're sort of told, we're made to believe that there was a generation who was basically always ready for war. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's okay. We're just waiting. You know, as soon as the green light goes, we're all sitting around here at home ready to go and start kidding. We're really up for that. Where I don't suppose that's really true of any general. No one actually wants to go off to war and die.
No. I mean, I think people will do it. Look at what's happening in Ukraine at the moment. The kind of the mobilization there of people who never have thought they'd go to war. But yeah, and I think you can see that in a lot of the testimony from the time of people kind of being called up and going because they knew they needed to, but not being thrilled about it, you know, and not all being these sort of like virtuous, patriotic, clean-limbed type people. There's an amazing book I quote from a lot in the called The Stuff to Give the Troops by a writer called Julian McLaren Ross, who ended up as a sort of proper Soho pisshead writer, like ruined his potential. And I think his novel, The Stuff to Give the Troops, is based a lot on his reality of his experience as a soldier. And everyone, no one can be asked. They're always trying to get out of duties. They've all like got loads of spots and they sort of fart all the time. And it's just horrible. You know what I mean? There's no kind of like clean-limbed young men going off to war. Obviously, you know, there was a percentage of people who were like that, but I don't think it was the majority. I think the majority sort of got on with it because they had to, and they were more keen about surviving, really, and getting back home again.
So, you know, you mentioned there that you were never like much of a footballer, and you mentioned in the book as well, you know, you felt that in your sense of your own masculinity, you felt shortcomings when you were younger, like in terms of physical stuff. Tell me more about that and how that sort of inspired you to explore all of this.
I guess it was like teenagers. I went to a kind of weird state school that was like used to be a grammar school, but then it was just a normal normal secondary school. But it was all boys, and it was quite like traditional. And it was obsessed with rugby, and whether you were good at rugby or not, kind of did a lot of this sort of sorting out of who was popular. And I hated rugby. I was rubbish at it. I had no interest. And then so I really didn't feel like I was fitting in with the masculinity at the time of my peers. There was a lot of bullying. It was very homophobic. And, you know, at that point in my teenage years, I was kind of really confused about sexuality. I just didn't know where I was ending up. And remember that time, it was 90s, was pretty homophobic. You still had Section 28 in the legislative books forbidding the kind of teaching of about sexuality in schools. Tories were really homophobic. Culture generally was. Football was. And that started putting me off. And then I started feeling like this war culture. So these men weren't ever gay. You know, they never fancied other men. They were all straight. You know, the only gay bloke I knew of who'd been in the war was Kenneth Williams. And he seemed to be this sort of camp. I mean, I love him. I still, he's one of my heroes. But he just didn't seem like a man's man. And I was like, do I fit in with any of this? And then it was the kind of coming together of football and war that really put me off completely, off both in a way. It was like the 96 England versus Germany game in the Euros, and there was that Piers Morgan's front page of the Mirror going like with the picture of Stuart Pearce in the tin helmet, and it was like just all this war rhetoric, and I guess I was a bit
I think the headline was "For You Fritz, the Euros war- are over
yeah, exactly. And it goes on and on inside with this sort of like pompous, trying to sound like Churchill or whatever. It's just rubbish. And then, you know, after we lost inevitably, all the load of geezers going and smashed up Trafalgar Square singing about two world wars and one world cup. And I was just like, that was kind of it for me. And maybe I sometimes think, was I just a bit too, you know, I think I was so afraid of masculinity. I pushed it all away too much. And I was like, I can't be doing this anymore. Got into music instead. That kind of music took over at that point. And that was where I was finding like more fruitier people, I suppose, in the musical world. But yeah, and that's why I wrote the book in a way. It was like in recent years, kind of getting back into a lot of the stuff I was into when I was a kid, and like building aeroplanes. I started doing that again, getting back into finding my way back into being openly into football. I always say I was always quite open about being like fluid in sexuality, but I was a closet football fan just because in my world of music or whatever, to be into football was like really frowned at, you know.
Right.
Seen as being a bit rum. So I was always like closet West Ham fan. Now I'm out and everything really.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the past 5 or 6 years just kind of getting really sort of getting to grips with what masculinity is and feeling more comfortable in traditionally masculine scenarios and so on. I wanted to go back into looking into the war, and also having a kid, having a son, I wanted to sort of think about how I relate to masculinity in the context of him. And also culturally, just starting to feel really fed up with this constant like finger wagging rants about toxic masculinity and so on. Just feeling like there's more complicated and nuanced ways of looking at it than to just chuck us all in a bin.
Is it more comfortable? Is it easier to sort of pick and choose your masculine identity nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of hope so. I guess for me, growing up with this feeling, it was I more into men or women? And that bisexuality didn't really exist. Well, it existed, obviously, but it wasn't really talked about, you know, in a big way, culturally, I felt. It was, and I think now there is more fluidity. Like, I can be out, you know, I'm married to a woman, I've got a son, but it doesn't mean that I'm not still, you know, into men or whatever. I think that it is possible to be out in a more fluid way. I think sometimes the people are a bit more positive about it than is actually the case. I think for a lot of people, it's still really hard. A lot of people are still struggling with that, particularly bisexual men. I do think that's a really hard identity to be in. I think bisexual women, it's almost like been fetishized for ages. Like men find it arousing. I think there's often a flip side where women find bisexual men threatening because there's a lot of, you know, insecurity around fidelity and so on. So I think it's complicated, but I think we're moving to a place where people can be a bit more open about who they are, a bit more fluid. People can talk about it more, and that's positive. I mean, it depends where you are. I mean, I'm in London. I do think London is like a place where you go to. I mean, I did. I moved here because I wanted to spend my 20s misbehaving, getting up sexy mischief, I suppose, and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure it's the same everywhere. London does allow you to do that, and that's a privilege of being here. But, you know, and I talk to mates who've got teenage kids, and they say it's a lot more, like, again, in London, but for their teenage kids, they don't give a shit whether people in their school are gay.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I went to school in London, and, you know, and I never thought of it as homophobic at all at the time. But I look back now and I think, oh yeah, it's like absolutely a homophobic place. There was a, you know, a couple of guys who, if not out, were certainly, you know, very camp, and people sort of deemed them to be gay, and they must have had hell throughout school. But it was very straightforward. And now my kids, funny enough, they go to the same school I went to.
Oh, wow.
And it's very casual, like the way that they sometimes will drop in that there's, you know, someone who's bisexual or someone who's gay or whatever it is, you know, in their school. And it just seems like not unremarkable. But I think you're right. It might be different around different parts of the country. I mean, you know, with all this stuff, even with what I've tried to do with the reset is to sort of show people that, again, even with discussions of mental health or anything, you know, to do with feelings or emotions, that again used to be considered very unmasculine, and you had to make a choice of either being a bit of a geezer or being the sort of person who was a bit weird and wanted to talk about mental health. I feel like those things are breaking down a little bit now, and that you can still be one of the lads, but switch relatively easily if you need to into talking about stuff that's that little bit deeper.
Yeah, I agree, because I used to sort of be wary of being one of the lads, and I've kind of realised that probably actually that the way I am with my friends, that's sort of what my I actually am. I was like fighting it for ages. It's weird. I've embraced it more, that sense of, like, I don't know, that camaraderie, but also like and like quite a twisted humour and piss taking, all of that. Like, yeah. I don't know. I did it, but I felt guilty about it. Now I don't. And I do think, but you know, I do think people talk more about mental health. I do notice, you know, in my own case, I do suffer from depression and like fucking chronic self-esteem problems and all this sort of stuff. And I do, yeah, I still feel like I have that stereotypical male response sometimes of shutting down, you know.
Yeah.
It's all right. We can sort of say to people, oh, you need to reach out. Do your friends are going to be there for you, whatever. But it's hard to train yourself to do that. It's easier to shut down a lot of the time, I think. But I do see a positive trend, and I do. I think you see it out and about, don't you? I notice the way blokes are together has changed, just even when you observe them. I was even having some kids from the secondary school around the corner. I was walking up the road pushing my son in the pram, and they were all like walking along the pavement, like four lads arm in arm, having a lovely chat
after really school. Nice.
And they all had to get out of the way for me pushing my pram. And they were like, oh, sorry about it. And I was like, wow, you wouldn't have seen that when I was a kid.
Absolutely not.
It was just, it was really, I was like, wow, this is amazing. You know, and they were kind of like just average looking fellas. Yeah.
Is the fact that men are becoming nicer, younger men in particular, men younger than us, I think you're right. You know, they just seem like generally kind of get more polite people. Is that why they're being labelled by your Piers Morgans of this world as snowflakes? Does it just mean they're nicer?
Yeah. They're nicer, and they're not just shitting on other people constantly to get to the top, which is what you did, isn't it? I mean, I do think it comes with a caveat that you people like Andrew Tate spouting his stuff, which I do see as toxic masculinity, the way he talks about women and the way he's basically made this sort of bro pyramid scheme where you join his weird little society, and then there's like the guru dude at the top who's really in charge, but he puts Andrew Tate in front.
I
talk to people I know are teachers and mates who've got teenage kids, and my missus worked on a film about Andrew Tate, and it is terrifying that there's a certain subset of young men who really latch on to what he's spouting. But I think that's because they're in a vulnerable position, because they are probably insecure like we all are when we're teenagers, and they're getting that feeling where they're constantly told, you are a man, you're a toxic male, buddy, buddy, bar. And if you tell somebody they are something like that, they're going to start believing it. And Andrew Tate saying, I'm going to save you from all that. I can make you feel proud of being a man. And that involves being shitty to women. So what? But, I mean, I find him, it's weird, whether it's an age thing, or when I first saw a video of him, I was just like pissing myself laughing. He's on an air private jet that's clearly not taken off in the air, and he's got a cigar and a whiskey, and it was kind of like high ultra macho and incredibly camp. And I read an amazing article by a brilliant writer called Emma Garland. She was talking about him, and she was like, there was some quote where he's going about how much he hates eating, and eating just makes him revolted with himself.
Yeah, I saw that.
And she's like, this is exactly what you'd get on like an anorexic forum for teenage girls. Which was such a brilliant point, you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of wonder where he actually sits in masculinity. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I do think he's a cultural...
He's also very preening. I mean, he's
he's
a preening person. Which I'm not saying there's anything inherently wrong with being preening, right? Fair enough. But it's like, it's not really, it doesn't fit in with traditional masculine stereotypes, does it?
No, I mean, probably not back to what, I don't know, like the 18th century where they were all like preening their wigs or something.
He very often, I mean, maybe I've imagined this, but in his image, in his pictures, he's often got like a sort of quite figure-hugging tuxedo jacket on, but with nothing underneath.
It's very waxed.
I don't think you could wear that to West Ham very easily, for example.
I don't think you could you? No, I really don't think you could. But I do think he's, I made a good point, I felt, which was like, there's always like a cultural phenomenon that's feared because of its influence on young men. Like in the 90s, it was hip hop and rap music. Like this is violent, misogynistic culture that's leading young men astray and influencing them to do bad things. And I do think he is the modern incarnation of that kind of sort of regular occurrence in cultural paranoia. But he does have that direct way to contact people or to get in people's faces because he's an online creation.
It's interesting you say that about hip hop because, of course, people were like very worried about that. And I suppose looking back, you know, when certain acts were coming out, their lyrics at the time would have been very shocking. But how many people do you know of our generation who became obsessed with that music when they were kids and still love it now, but are kind of very metropolitan liberal?
Yeah, all of them.
Those lyrics had no lasting impact on their worldview or their values whatsoever.
I mean, I used to kind of have the, again, like I was saying, I used to react against all this masculinity in a way that I think was a bit uptight. And then it was when I saw somebody pointing out, like, when Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds did their Murder Ballads album, there's more people killed on that record than any hip-hop record. Nick Cave was actually going to gangster rap gigs at the time to get influence. And it's got all these insane songs like Stagger Lee, when he, like, I crawl over 50 girls' good pussies just to get to one fat boy's asshole. Like, right. You know, it's amazing. Yeah, yeah. It's totally wrong, but it's Nick Cave doing it, so it's fine. And that really changed my perspective of it, you know. And I think actually one of the things that really changed my perception of like where I felt around masculinity was when grime appeared. Because suddenly I heard this like masculinity, which a lot of that early grime was very male and very kind of cocky, but it was so funny and so fast. And it had an insecurity in it as well. And I sort of realized at that point, you know, piss taking has you opening yourself up, aren't you? There's something about a piss-taking interaction, whether it's a kind of grime thing or just with your mates, where by firing out, you're leaving yourself vulnerable to the comeback. And then you know, it's all these things that are probably not rocket science to most blokes, but for me, I kind of realised and felt very different about it afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's more complicated.
You're obviously not a fan of the kind of Andrew Tate form of toxic masculinity, but do you think that, like, accusations of us all somehow, you know, we can all walk down the street? So, certainly those of us who are of a liberal bent can sort of almost find ourselves post Me Too and whatever, just feeling guilty waking up in the morning and having waking up in the morning and having a piss. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I agree. That first one of the day, that's a lot of volume, isn't it? I find, but again, that's one of those male things where it's very satisfying. You know, I like that. It's almost some of those weird things that are quite blokey and quite basic. I love, you know, I have primal things. Yeah. You know, I have a couple of mates, but we're always talking about shits and that. You know, it's great. But I think it's weird because I do think we are wired biologically to have certain responses to, I don't know, attractive women, sort of nudity, all these sorts of things. And you do find yourself kind of going, oh, should I have thought that at this point? You know, there is a sort of element of judgment, and it takes a bit of processing. And I think there's a big difference between Andrew Tate and everyone else. We're not all in that same basket.
Right. Last area of all this stuff that I want to ask you about is, do you have any thoughts on the, and it's very, it's sort of parallel to Andrew Tate, maybe a much more diluted and parochial thing, but, you know, the high performance form of masculinity that we read so much about now, the whole kind of like, you know, the get up at 5 a.m, have an ice bath and optimize your protocols kind of masculinity, which has really taken off. It's kind of like, I call it LinkedIn personality, masculinity. Do you know what I mean? Where everything's about, we're all engaged in a competition and we all need to be our absolute very best selves every day in order to conquer the competition and be the best. And this has really taken off in a huge way. Podcasts, you know, Diary of a CEO, High Performance, and there's so many other books and stuff. I mean, what's your take on that?
I mean, it just seems a bit much to me. I'm not a high performance individual. I don't know. It's weird. I mean, I've not encountered anyone ever like that, I suppose. So it's kind of hard. I know it's sort of existing in the culture, but I just never encountered those kind of people in the day to day. But I mean, it's weird because it is very survival of the fittest, isn't it? It's getting back to a kind of very basic, primal, primitive sort of masculinity. I mean, I'm not getting up at 5 a.m. for an eye bath. I really resent my son when he decides he wants to go and play with Thomas at 5 a.m. And let alone, and I like Thomas the Tank Engine, well into it, but I'm not getting in an ice bath, don't worry.
And just taking it all back to the stuff in your book, I mean, you know, whether it's Andrew Tate or whether it's, you know, woman, you know, old womanizing men, or whether it's high performance guys, do you feel that it's all this sort of, you know, people still kind of struggling to live up to this idea of that sort of war generation that we all grew up sort of having presented to us as like an ideal and the sort of thing we should all be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, again, that's one of those things that's always been there in culture, isn't it? Like the kind of back to like ancient Greece and the heroic ideal or whatever. I bet the Romans with the gladiators, but it was a bit like that, you know. I don't know, it's just the war generation. I do think they're very useful to hold up as this sort of ideal because of these simplistic cultural narratives. It's easy to go, look at these young men who sacrificed everything and went away and came back. And that ignores the stuff I write about in the book, just what they actually got up to, particularly sexually. You know, there was a sexual revolution in the Second World War. I argue is bigger than the 60s because it was everybody, not just a sort of bit of an elite, cultural elite doing it. And that's why I want to sort of break that down a little bit, just to sort of say, you know, we've just got a whole look at ourselves. We shouldn't be compared to the past all the time. We've just got to look at what we're doing in the here and now, really.
Fascinating stuff. The book's great. It's called Men at War. What's it out? Is it out in paperback yet? Or is it?
It's out in hardback now, which means you can get it quite cheap in hardback. And then it's coming out in paperback in April if you don't want to lug around a big old book.
Brilliant. Keep an eye out for it. Luke, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And I hope to see you at West Ham one of these days now that you've re-embraced it.
Hopefully see you there at some point. That'd be amazing.
Luke, thanks ever so much for joining me.
Cheers, Sam. Thanks.
That was Luke Turner. Check out his book. I'll put a link in the show notes. He's a great guy and a fantastic writer. Thanks for listening as always, gang. Please remember to subscribe to The Reset at samdelaney.substack.com and buy my book, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks, available now at Audible for a special offer of $2.99. You can also buy it normal as a paperback soon or whatever. Until next time, be lucky and don't let the dickheads get you down.